adversary that it hurts very much. See? As all of these things, and basically in Germany at that time, people in the church who were generally bourgeois people looked upon these laws either disinterestedly or supportively. They thought those are necessary measures at this critical time. Here the communists are coming, burning down the Reichstag. We have to have emergency powers, see, for the government. And so personal rights were wiped out. February 28th, the day after the burning of the Reichstag. March 1st, there was a boycott of all Jewish stores in Berlin. I mean, this is all 1933. This is all, I mean, it's amazing, you know, 15, 20, 30 days. It's just like clockwork. March 1st, there's a boycott of all Jewish stores in Berlin. KDW, Kaufhaus des Westens, is one of those big department stores in Berlin, still is. They set a police cordon around that department store, the Jewish department store, and said people cannot shop here because it's a non-Aryan store. Julie Bonhoeffer, Bonhoeffer's grandmother, 91 years old, went through that police cordon with an umbrella and went into that store to make a purchase. That was March 1st. March 24th, they passed what they called the Enabling Law, the Ermächtigungsgesetz, which was the final stage of this Ordinances for the Protection of the People and the State. The ordinances withdrew personal rights, but the Enabling Law placed unlimited powers into the hands of the government to put those ordinances into operation. That's one reason, again, why a lot of people since 1964, the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, have been very nervous about the fact that through some kind of historical accident, our government placed into the hands of the president unlimited powers to do whatever he felt necessary in this emergency situation with this torpedo boat in the Gulf of Tonkin. So we have the Enabling Act, March 24th. I don't want to make, you know, these historical parallels in such a way that it sounds as though I'm saying we're in the same situation as they were in then. I get very nervous with people who do that then I do not vibrate very well to Dan Berrigan, for instance, who does this, I think, in a very, very sloppy kind of way. But the parallels, though not exact, are close enough to be interesting.
I just happen to think of the 60 Minutes program where they pointed out that maybe the United States was shooting at ghosts on it. Yeah. And that's comparable to the, yeah, right?
Well, we're in a whole era, it seems to me, when the study of that, and then after that we've got the Nuremberg trial, you know, that's another whole interesting thing. We've got the Pentagon Papers thing. It's just there are all kinds of terribly contemporary things. Yeah, I didn't say it, but that's right. Yeah, thank you. Right. Okay, they didn't have to have any additional laws after that Enabling Act of March 24, 33. That was less than 2 months after Hitler came into power, and the Nazis did everything they did legally, everything, because they had that thing on the books from March 24th. They were very, the Nazis were very, very attentive to legal procedures. They were not just tearing around doing anything. They did everything legally. The problem is that they had laws on the books that enabled them to do the kinds of things that they did. Okay, this was, all of this was going on during Bonhoeffer's first year of teaching at the university. So in addition to his own involvement with that chaplaincy at Charlottenburg Technical University and teaching this confirmation class and living in vetting and ecumenical work, he was also involved in all the turmoil of these early Nazi days. Well, he was, the handwriting was very much on the wall. University professors are Beamters or civil servants in Germany. They work not only for the university, but they're on the government's civil service payroll. And the non-Aryan clause was passed in the government. And there was allegiance required, a pledge of allegiance to Hitler, the leader, by all civil servants. Wasn't necessarily immediately applied to everybody, but if you worked for the government, you pledged allegiance not only to the flag, but you pledged allegiance to the Führer, right? And Bonhoeffer saw that he would simply not be able to do that. A lot of other people did too. Paul Tillich came out, huh? And Albert Einstein, and floods and floods of people in those early years. And Bonhoeffer was not a professor. He was a voluntary, private, tutor kind of person, a privato sense. But he saw that that was a terribly, terribly difficult time, and he struggled with what to do. He wanted by this time very much to be a pastor. That wasn't an original intent of his, but he wanted to preach, he wanted to serve a congregation. The opportunity came to go to London and to serve a congregation of German people in London, and he took it. And so he left in 1935 after teaching a year and a half, 2 years, and went to serve a congregation in London. After he got there, he wrote to Karl Barth and told him that he had gone. And Karl Barth said, "You're out of your tree, your house is burning, and you run away instead of staying there to put out the fire. What in the world is wrong with you?" And Bonhoeffer says, "I knew that you were going to say that, that's why I didn't write and ask." And in a way, you could interpret that leave to London as a kind of a, as some kind of a cop-out, some kind of refusal to really face the issues, but he served there 18 months. During the time that he was there, he was back in back and forth in and out of Germany all the time, kept contact with the church people there, the resistance movement, kept contact with ecumenical relations. He interpreted to the people in England what the situation in Germany was. That congregation is still there in Germany, and it was recently served by Vincent Meckler, who was a colleague of Bonhoeffer's in the Confessing Church. So, 18 months there. Again, he decided that he wanted to go to India, and he had a good friend, Bishop Fell, who knew Gandhi and who arranged a meeting with him. And he was all set to go to India for the second time, and the Confessing Church in Germany asked him to come back and to lead a an illegal seminary for training pastors for the Confessing Church. So now we have to say something about the Confessing Church. I'm wondering if we ought not to stop there. And for those of you who have not been here before, we're talking about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And very briefly, he was born in 1906 in Breslau, Germany. He spent his life as a German pastor and theologian. He, during the war, was in the resistance movement and wound up in concentration camp and was killed by the Nazis in 1945. He has become, particularly since his death, and various of his writings have come to light, a very important person for the church and a very exciting person for many people and I think for many different kinds of reasons. And what we've been trying to do these last couple of hours is to try to say something about his life and times, because his life and times reflect so beautifully what it is that he wrote, and vice versa. He did what he said, and he said what he did. And so the biographical thing is very important. I'm going to wrap that up today, come whatever, because I think that we have to get on to the examination of some of the text and some of his ideas and some of the ways in which he talks about the Christian faith and life. So I'll say some things about the rest of the Bonhoeffer life thing, and we have an opportunity, I hope, to talk about that a little bit before the period is over today. We had taken him to England in 1933, October of 1933, and he served there in London a German congregation. While he was there, he made frequent trips back to Germany. He attended any number of ecumenical conferences, and a lot of people from Germany came to see him. He not only served that congregation, but he interpreted Germany to the people in England, and vice versa. It was a very, very busy time, but he found plenty of time to attend the theater and the opera in London, and he knew every good curry house in Soho. In 1935, the Confessing Church in Germany called him back to start an illegal seminary in Germany to train pastors for the Confessing Church. And that's what he spent his time doing between 1935 and 1939. So there's a four-year slot there where Bonhoeffer is intimately tied up with the life of the Confessing Church. And so I think we have to have a little parenthesis here and say some things about the Confessing Church in Germany. And maybe we should do that topically rather than chronologically. Hitler did not come into power on an anti-church or anti-God or anti-Christian or anti-Bible ticket. He came into power on an anti-communist ticket. It was the communists who were against God. Hitler was all for God. Was for God, for Bible, for church. He said Christianity is, after all, the basis of our German nation, the basis of our German morality. And so it became a little bit tricky to know how to respond to that. There was one thing that was very, very clear, however, about the brand of Christianity that the Nazis supported, and that is that there was no question but that they ruled the Jews out of any possibility of becoming Christians, because Christianity was amalgamated with the German race for those people. And they called themselves then German Christians. They're very, very concerned about that. Now, I suppose there are all kinds of things that feed into that. I think that anybody who has studied the Treaty of Versailles or lived through that time between the First and Second World War realizes that Germany was really humiliated at the end of the First World War. They smarted tremendously under the Treaty of Versailles. They were struggling for identity. They were struggling for nationhood. They were struggling for some kind of pride. They were struggling to get their economy going again. And so nationalism, identity, German identity, was a very, very natural thing to worry about. And it was also a natural thing to worry about the communists from the East. And Hitler built on that kind of trend toward German nationalism, and he also built on a very pervasive and incipient kind of anti-Semitism. Christianity poured through that sieve, came out in such a way that there were people, for instance, who said, Adolf Hitler, yesterday, today, and forever. There were bishops who said that. There were people who said, in the beginning was the race, and the race was with God, and the race was God. There was in the Magdeburg Cathedral, in the very early days of the Nazi regime, the cross of Jesus Christ and the altar paraments, and also a flood of German swastikas. And the pastor, the bishop in that cathedral, said, well, this is simply a symbol of our nationhood. Much the same way that many pastors, having an American flag and a Christian flag in the chancel, would say, well, what's wrong with that? We're Americans, aren't we? So they say, what's wrong with that? Of course, we're Germans, and we're German Christians, and so the swastika belongs in the chancel. There were uniformed SS troopers, stormtroopers, who came to church on Sunday, marching in like on Boy Scout Sunday, you know, at the right time, marching down, sitting in the front pews. Some pastors said, well, that's great. I never saw that bird in church before. It's wonderful. It's an evangelistic opportunity. We'll preach them the gospel. So there were all kinds of ways in which responsible men of integrity, Christian people, got taken in, I guess we would say from this perspective, by this brand of Christianity, which had Jesus and Bible and all kinds of other things, but which was hyper, super nationalistic and radically anti-Semitic. Now, there were other people in Germany who said, it's true that the Christian faith can be expressed in many different ways. There's a great diversity of theological and confessional expression in the body of Jesus Christ. There is even such a thing as heresy, and heresy is an interpretation of the Christian faith which is still inside the church, but which screws it up, you know, royally, one way or another, and heretics have to be addressed. But what we're talking to now, what we're finding going on in the church now, is not a diverse expression of the faith, and it's not just a heresy. This is apostasy. This is turning the back on Jesus Christ. This is rejecting Jesus Christ. This is blasphemy. This is the substitution of Germanism for Christianity. This is a time of not this or that or maybe, but this is a time when the church has to say yes or no. And these people formed at first an outfit called the Pastors Emergency League, which was started by Martin Niemöller and others, and it later grew into an outfit which called itself the Confessing Church, the Bekennende Kirche. And so there were these two groups in Germany from 1933, 4, and on, the German Christians and the Confessing Church. Now, it also ought to be said that it wasn't as though those two groups were clearly and simply definable and circumscribable. There were many, many shades in each group, and maybe there were even some overlappings in each group.
group. There were people who were German Christians with a passion, and there were people who were German Christians and who didn't even know it. There was a huge number of people who didn't even know what the issues were. There were other people who said they're neutral. They decided not to make a choice one way or the other. So it's not as though everybody had to be on one team or the other, but there were these two definable groups. Very early in the game, Hitler saw, who certainly was no Christian, but who talked Christianity, said that now what we have to do with this nation is to unite it. We have to unite it into the Third Reich. There was the Roman Empire, there was the Holy Roman Empire, and now there is going to be the Third Reich, which will last 1,000 years. And if we're going to be a united people, we have to be united not only politically, but we have to be united ecclesiastically. We have to have one church in Germany. Now, some of you know more about this than I do, and please shout out and correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, there has never been in Germany a church. There are Landeskirchen, there are provincial churches. There is the Church of Bavaria, the Church of Württemberg, the Church of Berlin-Brandenburg, the Church of Hanover. And the EKD, the Evangelical Church in Germany, is not a church even today, but it is a federation of land churches or provincial churches. The Evangelical Church in Germany is a kind of a national council of churches. Well, Hitler said, we have to have one church. We have to join these land churches into one, and we have to have one bishop over these churches. And so he handpicked a bishop by the name of Ludwig Miller, who was a German Christian, who was very sympathetic to the Nazis. And there was a long, long struggle about whether or not that would get pulled off. The Confessing Church put up a guy by the name of Wohlschwing from Bethel. And Wohlschwing actually was elected as Reichsbishop. But the Nazis, of course, found a way to maneuver around that, and they put such heat on him that he resigned, and they tried again to get in their own man. The provincial churches varied a great deal in the degree to which they succumbed to German Christianity. And so the Church of Berlin-Brandenburg, for instance, had mostly German Christians, and there were not very many confessing Christians. The Church of Württemberg was never taken over by the German Christians. The Church of Bavaria was never taken over by the German Christians. The Church of Hanover was never taken over by the German Christians. And so the place where the confessing church really developed and got its identity and had most of its struggle and power, for that matter, was in those churches where the German Christians really took over. Now, there was all kinds of struggle and bad feelings between these various land churches. And the people in Berlin-Brandenburg, which is where Bonhoeffer and Galwitzer and Martin Niemöller and Günther Harder and all these people were, said, our church has been destroyed by the German Christians. And we are going under for the third time. And it's a moment when we have to confess Jesus Christ concretely in order for the church to survive. The people down in Bavaria, in Württemberg, in Hanover said, that's your problem, baby. We don't have that problem. There are German Christians here, but we have the majority, and we don't have that problem. So the people in the Confessing Church in Berlin-Brandenburg were crying out for help from those other places, and those other places said, we're sorry, but that's your problem. We don't want to make a big mess here because we really don't have a big mess. So they started talking about the destroyed churches where the German Christians took over and the intact churches where the German Christians had not taken over. And the people in the intact churches always called the others the so-called destroyed churches. You people who know German know how malicious you can be with that word sogenannte. You can really kill people with that word. The people in the intact churches talked about the so-called destroyed churches, and the people in the destroyed churches talked about the so-called intact churches. And that still remains today. When people write about that time, if they were members of the churches where the German Christians had not taken over, they tend to talk about the so-called destroyed churches and vice versa. So it's a very, very complicated picture from that point of view. Another problem was that pastors in Germany today and then were civil servants. They were on the civil service rolls. They were government officials. Not only government officials, but they are government officials. They are Beamters. Well, that means that the government has a hand in saying what is legal and what is not legal. And the government said that the confessing church, this group that grew up in opposition to the German Christians, the confessing church was an illegal church. That didn't necessarily mean that every person who was a confessing Christian was thrown in jail. It wasn't illegal in that sense, but it was unofficial. That meant that pastors, for instance, could not be ordained. It meant that they couldn't hold property. It meant that they couldn't handle offerings. It meant that they couldn't get the money collected through the tax system. It was an illegal church in the sense that it was an unofficial church. So they started their own illegal seminary, which was not at first necessarily against the law in the sense that to do it was immediately to be thrown into jail, but it was to work in a church which was not officially recognized and which was therefore illegal. And pastors who worked in that church were not sure of salary, they were not sure of any kind of pension, their ordination was illegal, and all of that kind of thing. As the story moved on, and as time developed, there grew a core of men who had been trained in the confessing church seminaries, and they did not have official ordination. And so all of the legal things that a pastor can do and should do, they were not able to do. But there were also pastors in the confessing church who joined the confessing church after they had been, let's say they had been ordained in 1927 or 1922. They had their ordination. They were official Beamters. They were civil servants. They were legal pastors, but they were pastors in the confessing church. Another guy comes along, and he takes a seminary training in 1936, and he gets illegal ordination, and his life is completely different from this other guy, although they're both in the confessing church. Well, it wasn't very long before these younger guys started saying, hey now, that's an historical accident, you know, that you were ordained in 22 and I'm ordained in 35. How about either you renouncing your ordination and get ordained in the confessing church, or how about me going over some night, 1 o'clock a.m. in some basement, turn out the lights, and I'll get ordained by some guy who is not a confessing church member, and I'll be legally ordained, and then we'll be on a par with one another. Well, that's a very natural kind of problem to arise. And so there developed what they called Way A, which was a rigid system of ordination which said confessing church pastors can be pastors in the confessing church only if they received their ordination from confessing church pastors. There was way B, which said that confessing church seminarians can get their ordination from an official, legal ordainer and still be pastors in the confessing church. Now, you know, from this stance, I think all of us would say, way A is the only way. And of course, some did that. Bonhoeffer treated in a pastoral way and stayed in good relationship with his students, both who went way A and who went way B. But you can see how, as soon as that happens, the lines become kind of fuzzy. The thing gets kind of messed up. And it isn't just whether you're for or against, but there are shades of gray in there. And it isn't just whether you're for or against, but there are shades of gray in there. Okay, another problem in the confessing church is that, I think I said this the other day, for these people, confessing is a verb, it's not a noun, it's not just adhering to the Augsburg Confession, but it is confessing Jesus Christ concretely in this situation. They said the Antichrist is not in Rome, he's in Berlin. We have to, the problem is not Gnosticism or Docetism or Arianism or some ancient heresy. The problem is Arianism, that is the, that's the problem. Anti-Semitism is the problem. And so we have to confess Jesus Christ anew. And so the confessing church people met at Bethel in Germany, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Hermann Sasse, who later went to Australia, wrote a draft for a confession for the confessing church. That went through a number of stages and was adopted. The great confession that came out of the confessing church was the confession at Barmen in 1934. And today, in the Church of Berlin-Brandenburg,
In the hymn book, there is Luther's Catechism, the Augsburg Confession, and the Barmen Confession. The Barmen Confession stands on the same plane of authority and commitment as does the Augsburg Confession of the 16th century. So Barmen was a great time. Karl Barth was a very important figure there, and the Barmen Confession is really a thrill to read. It's an extremely Christocentric confession, and it says very, very specifically that Christianity is a matter of the confession of Jesus Christ and not a matter of race. Comes through over and over and over again. Now, they soon saw that organization, institution, is in this situation a necessary mark of the church. That is, it was not possible in that legal, illegal kind of situation to be a loose fellowship of Christians. They had to ordain, baptize, use monies, pay salaries, perhaps have some properties. The institutional aspects of the church were something that simply couldn't be neglected. And so at Dahlem, there was another synod. There were in all, I think, 11 or 13 synods in addition to Barmen, that is, meetings of the confessing church. And at Dahlem, and again at Einhausen, the confessing church said, the marks of the church are not just the preaching of the word and the administration of the sacraments. Those of you who know the Augsburg Confession know that it says the church is the people of God where the word is rightly preached and the sacraments rightly administered. That's a Lutheran thing to say. These people in the confessing church said, the word is proclaimed, the sacraments administered, but we must also say something about church structure. And they did say something about church structure. And at that point, Hermann Saffi, who was a super Lutheran, pulled out, and with him, most of the Lutherans pulled out of the confessing church because they said the Augsburg Confession says that church order and church structure is not a part of the church. The confessing church people said that was all right in the 16th century. Today it is a part of the mark of the church. So that was a problem of that divided people. Maybe we'll just leave it there. Let's say that the confessing church was when I look back at that time from this viewpoint, there is no question in my mind but that's where I would have been. Had I been there at that time, maybe I wouldn't have. But our sympathies from this point in history, I think, are all with the confessing church. Maybe a couple of other things I should say. There were congregations. A friend of mine in Germany was a member of a congregation where one of the pastors was a German Christian, the other pastor was a confessing church Christian, in the same congregation. One guy'd read the gospel, the other guy'd read the epistle. One guy preached at the 9 o'clock service, the other guy preached at the 11 o'clock service. Same congregation. Maybe a lot of people in the congregation didn't even know what their identity was. But there were, in some of those congregations of mixed German Christians and confessing church people, a cluster of confessing church people who would then have their own meetings, and they had a red card that they were given. I am a member of the confessing church, and I forget what it says, but there's a little membership card that was red. And Bonhoeffer wrote a little piece one time where he took off from an old formula by Cyprian that says, outside of the church there's no salvation. That's the famous old thing that can be argued about and has been argued about. I think improperly understood it's ludicrous, properly understood it's quite right. Bonhoeffer took off from that and said, he who knowingly separates himself from the confessing church in Germany separates himself from the church of Jesus Christ. Now, he qualified that, he covered the objections, he wrote on and on. You can read that article, it was a beautiful article, but of course people heard that second and third hand, and what that got to be translated was,
if you don't have a red card, you go to hell. That isn't what he said. He said, he who knowingly separates himself from the confessing church in Germany separates himself from the Church of Jesus Christ. So it was a life and death struggle. By 1937, there were over 800 confessing church pastors in prison. There was no possibility of being a confessing church pastor and or member, for that matter, and obeying all the laws. There was probably no possibility of anybody obeying all the laws. In any police state, they have all kinds of laws on the books, as you well know, that they aren't applied all the time. But anybody in a police state can be picked up any time because there's always some law, you know, that he's broken. And so there are a lot of those people in prison. All right.
What percentage would that be? 800 out of how many, about, where, you know, is it around 9,000, something like that?
I think, Carol, that at the very beginning there were some 10,000. Yeah, right. Members in the confessing church. Yeah. Well, what happened was that the confessing church fell apart. That's why I mentioned this way A and way B business. There were all kinds of internal struggles. They fought about everything. The thing just disintegrated, partially because of internal struggle, partially, of course, because the screws were constantly being tightened by the government. You probably know that the Evangelical Church in Germany was the one unifying force between East and West Germany after the war. And that held up for almost 25 years. But through internal, but mostly through external pressures, that thing finally divided. What was it, a year ago or so? And the Evangelical Church in Germany is now in West Germany, and the people in the East have their own church because they say they have their own culture and they have to have their own church. The same was true during those years in the Nazi regime. They tightened the screws so much that the thing finally fell apart. And Walter Dress, who was married to Bonhoeffer's younger sister, Suzanne, told me there never was a confessing church. There were many confessing churches, you know. The thing never really got totally united. Another guy told me, Pastor Perel told me, that by 1939, the confessing church was finished, forby, gone, because it just slowly disintegrated and kind of died. And in the letters and papers, Bonhoeffer makes some very negative statements about the confessing church, and he kind of lost his confidence in it. So it's hard to say, you know, who was in prison because he was a confessing church member and not. It's a very sad, tragic story. There's a beautiful thing to start out with, but it did kind of die. Well, Bonhoeffer was called back then from London. He'd been there for 18 months about, serving this German congregation. He was called back by the confessing church to start this illegal seminary to train men for this confessing church. They started at Zinkst on the Baltic Sea, then they went to Finkenwalde. And it was a small group, like 20, 30 men. And Eberhard Baitke came there as a student. Baitke is his biographer and his editor and the owner of his papers, etc. He came there as a student in 1935. They had both just recently broken an engagement. They hit it off great with one another. They were both big ping pong players and whatever else they had in common, I don't know, but they became great friends. And this little group lived in an old house, not very large, and they did everything together. They ate together. They did dishes together. There was a time for recreation. They prayed together. They confessed together to one another. They preached. In the chapel at Finkenwalde, there was on the altar the word hapax. That's a Greek word that means once for all. We're talking about yesterday Bonhoeffer's commitment to the particularities, the specificities of the faith. Christianity was never religion in general. It was always hapax, the once-for-allness of the Christ event on the altar. Hapax. This is not some kind of general religiosity that can be mixed up with German nationalism. It is a Christianity that depends on that hapax event. They talk a lot about the Sermon on the Mount. They went into the surrounding community. They visited people. They went out in teams of two or three evangelistic teams, putting on services for local congregations. Bonhoeffer was in constant contact with his family in Berlin. One fellow who was at Finkenwalde that told me that every night after supper, he would see Bonhoeffer down at the end of the hall talking to his mother on the telephone. He made frequent trips back and forth to Berlin. He was still doing some lecturing at the university, but the screws were being constantly tightened. He was prohibited from making any public speeches. Then he was prohibited from publishing. Finally, he was prohibited from making any visits at all to Berlin. During that time, there are a number of little events, it seems to me, that say something about his life and his understanding of Christianity. One time he was trying to get Cost of Discipleship published, and the Nazis said, you may not publish any devotional or Christian literature. There is, in the collected works, the correspondence back and forth between Bonhoeffer and the German officials, in which he is trying to say, look, this is a purely scientific work. There is nothing devotional about it at all. I'm just trying to say in a purely scholarly, objective way what these words in Matthew 5 through 7 say. And they write back and they say, nothing doing. Bonhoeffer, you can't publish this. Then he writes back and says, come on, let me do it. No, yes, no, yes. And when he writes back every letter, he signs Heil Hitler, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. When I first was reading that, I just about died. I mean, my hero. What's he doing, you see? Well, that's part of situation ethics, you know, that he figured that it was important to get that book published. The Heil Hitler was a little, that was a little thing to get the letter read, you know. He knew what that meant, and so he operated. He was able to operate that way. Whether or not that was right, whether or not you or I would have done it, I don't know, but that was true that he did that. Another time he was with Baker in a Bierstube, when it came crackling over the radio that Hitler had marched successfully into Poland, I think it was on that occasion, and everybody stood up, Heil Hitler, and so did Dietrich. Heil Hitler, Bates is sitting next to him, he says, hey, what are you doing? and Bonhoeffer says, come on, not yet, this isn't worth dying for. Come on, see? So he goes, okay, Heil Hitler. That was an everyday experience, you see. Whether on this occasion, and this time, in this crisis, you know, it's worth losing your head. And he was quite able to make decisions like that, right or wrong. On another occasion, he took his group to Sweden on an ecumenical trip, and he got permission to do this from the government. And he went up there, and of course, while he was up there, he made all kinds of contacts. He met Bishop Bell there from England, talking to all kinds of people, brought his group back, and the government said, you shouldn't have gone, even though I think he did have permission to do it. They said, you shouldn't have gone, and they took back some publishing rights from him for going. And after that, he signed a little statement that he was not either a communist or a Jew. And by signing that statement, he was given back his rights to publish. those are just kind of little events that may make you think that he was a bad man, or that may make you have some idea of the complexities of that time. The thing moved from Winkenwalde to another place. Sigurd Puff, I think, was the place. Finally, Himmler closed down. Heinrich Himmler closed down the seminary, and they continued in a thing they called the Brethren House. It was by no means an official seminary, but there were a few people there who went around and visited congregations in which students were placed under supervising pastors, and they tried that way to carry on that work. Finally, that was found out, and that was outlawed, and so the Finkenwalde thing just finally, through the external screws being applied, died. Out of that period came the book Life Together, which was not some kind of abstract thing that Bonhoeffer sat down and wrote out of his head, but which is really a record of the kind of thing that in fact went on at Finkenwalde. Some people who read Life Together get very uptight about the fact that he says everybody should sing in unison, or, you know, read a psalm every day. They say, what kind of legalism is that? If I want to sing parts, I'll sing parts. All right, he's not talking about everybody for all time. Bonhoeffer is always talking specifically, concretely, about a place and a time. And when you got 20 monotones sitting there, you know, without an organ in that little place, that makes a lot more sense to sing in unison, right? You can't read that stuff thinking that he's making universal statements. He's making statements about a time and a place. That doesn't mean that they don't have significance and application for us. Okay, 1939, Hitler had begun to move. I think it was in 1938 that he had, quote, annexed Austria. Everybody knows that from The Sound of Music. And in 1939, he marched into Poland in March of that year. War seemed to be obvious and inevitable, and Bonhoeffer was wondering what to do now. He knew that he could not serve as a soldier in the Nazi army, and besides that, his friend Franz Hildebrandt, who was a pastor and a Jew, was not able to be ordained because of the Arian clause in the Constitution. He wanted to be at one with his friend Franz Hildebrandt. Baeke was about to be called up. There were all kinds of problems. He went to England. While he was in England, he met Reinhold Niebuhr, who was there giving his Gifford lectures, The Nature and Destiny of Man. He had known him from his study year in New York. Niebuhr said, look, we've got to get you out of Germany. We've got to get you out fast. And how would you like to teach at Union Seminary? Bonhoeffer said, well, I don't know if I'd like to do that. Maybe there's something else that I could do. Niebuhr said, there are a lot of German immigrants in New York who have fled the country. Maybe you could be a pastor to them. Bonhoeffer says, no, that doesn't appeal to me. He said, how about a lecture tour? Okay. So they talked back and forth, and there's a huge correspondence back and forth. Niebuhr writes to various friends in colleges and universities and says, look, I've got this young buck who's got something to say. Will you pay him $25 for a speech, free coffee and donuts for the people who come? They say, okay, we'll give him 15. He says, okay, we'll make it 20. So they back and forth, and he sets up a lecture tour, sets up a job at Union Seminary. They work with the government. They get him a leave visa, or whatever, an exit visa. And so Bonhoeffer goes in 1939, in the spring of the year, to New York City and begins to work at Union Theological Seminary. He might well have stayed there. He might well have spent his entire life there, and he might well have been around today on Morningside Heights. Surely that was the intention of Niebuhr. That was the intention of Van Dusen. That was the intention of those people at Union. And maybe he thought that himself, although he was very uncertain about it, and he thought maybe he'd spend a couple of years there. As a matter of fact, he was there a couple of weeks, and he thought, my goodness, I've made a horrible mistake. The place is blowing apart, and I'm running away. I can't do it. He stayed in New York less than 1 month, and he wrote this letter to Reinhold Niebuhr. He arrived he sailed from England on June 7th. He arrived in New York on June 12th, and he left again on July 7th. He was there less than a month. He might have been there the rest of his life. He wrote this letter to Reinhold Niebuhr. I have had time to think and to pray about my situation and that of my nation, and to have God's will for me clarified. I have come to the conclusion that I have made a mistake in coming to America. I must live through this difficult period of our national history with the Christian people of Germany. I will have no right to participate in the reconstruction of Christian life in Germany after the war if I do not share the trials of this time with my people. My brothers in the confessing church wanted me to go. They may have been right in urging me to do so, but I was wrong in going. Such a decision each man must make for himself. Christians in Germany will face the terrible alternative either of willing the defeat of their nation in order that Christian civilization may survive, or willing the victory of their nation and thereby destroying our civilization. I know which of these alternatives I must choose, but I cannot make that choice in security. He got on the boat, went back to Germany, arrived on July 25th, and on September 1st, 1 month later, 1939, Hitler invaded Poland and brought about the Anglo-French Declaration of War. The timing is simply unbelievable. So it was a whole new phase. From 1939 until 1945, Bonhoeffer is what Baker calls a contemporary. That is, he is no longer teaching at Finkenwalde, but he is working for the military intelligence. Now, that's another whole story. That's a very important thing to know, that people talk about Prussian militarism and sometimes talk about that in the same breath with Nazism. Not so. The major resistance to Hitler came precisely from the military. Not from the church, but from the military. That's where the resistance came. Here's a peculiar situation of being a confessing church pastor, a known opponent to Hitler, and at the same time working as a courier for military intelligence. So he was in and out of the country all the time. Of course, he could have gotten out of the country and stayed any time. He made a trip up to Sweden. He made a couple trips down to Geneva. One time he got to the border at Geneva, and they wouldn't let him in. And he said, call Karl Barth down in Basel. They called Karl Barth. He said, he's okay, and so they let him in. He went down to see Karl Barth. He went over to Geneva. He talked to Witzer Tuft, of the precursor of the World Council of Churches. He talked with Reinhold Niebuhr. He tried to get in touch with the American authorities, with the British authorities, to let them know that there was a resistance movement in Germany. And those people would not listen. After December 7th, 1941, post Pearl Harbor, there was a total blackout, total censorship on all news stories about the German resistance movement. Total blackout. Because as soon as you start to tell people that all Germans are not Nazis, you destroy the war effort. He went, he wrote parts of his ethics during those years. He was finally arrested. I'm going to go rapidly because I'm going to finish in about 5 minutes, because I think we better not talk about biography anymore after today. He was arrested in April of 1943. He was sent to Tegel prison. Tegel was a military prison. It was not a Gestapo prison. It was a military prison. And his uncle, Colonel von Hase, was commandant for the city of Berlin.
So, you know, he had pretty good treatment there. Of course, the Allied bombers came over, blowing the daylights out of the Borsig locomotive works next door, and he went through all of that. He didn't have steak, you know, for dinner. It was not all that great, but he didn't suffer at Tegel prison very much. He made friends with the guards, and he was able to smuggle stuff back and forth. He writes in his letters, tell Carl, this Carl Barth, tell Carl thanks a lot for the cigar he sent last Tuesday, all that kind of stuff. It's in Tegel prison where he wrote the stuff that comes out in letters and papers from prison. There were many attempts on Hitler's life, and after July 20th, Bonhoeffer was transferred to Prince Albrechtstrasse in Berlin, which was a Gestapo prison, not a military prison. And from that time on, there are only a few little smidgens from his pen. They lost track of him. It was only later that they found out that he had been moved finally when the going got too hot. I don't know, sometime you ought to read The Last Battle by Cornelius Ryan, which is the story of the Battle of Berlin. The Russians came in and in and in and in, and the Berliners kept the zoo open until 2 days before Rome collapsed. The only thing that kept going in Berlin was two breweries. They never shut down all the way through the whole business. But that got much too hot to keep important prisoners there. They took Bonhoeffer off to Buchenwald. And from Buchenwald, in a wood-burning truck, because they couldn't get coal, down into Flossenbürg. He arrived at Flossenbürg, and there he was shot and killed April 9th, 1945, a few days before that camp was liberated by the Allies. I guess that's it. Let me take 1 minute to read a poem that he wrote while he was in Tegel prison. And close with that. The title of the poem is Who Am I? It says, Who am I? They often tell me I stepped from my cell's confinement calmly, cheerfully, firmly, like a squire from his country house. Who am I? They often tell me I used to speak to my warders freely and friendly and clearly as though it were mine to command. Who am I? They also tell me I bore the days of misfortune equably, smilingly, proudly, like one accustomed to win. Am I then really all that which other men tell of? Or am I only what I myself know of myself, restless and longing and sick, like a bird in a cage, struggling for breath, as though hands were compressing my throat, yearning for colors, for flowers, for the voices of birds, thirsting for words of kindness, for neighborliness, tossing in expectation of great events, powerlessly trembling for friends at an infinite distance, weary and empty at praying, at thinking, at making saints, and ready to say farewell to it all. Who am I? This or the other? Am I one person today and tomorrow another? Am I both at once? A hypocrite before others, and before myself a contemptibly unwoebegone weakling? Or is something within me still like a beaten army fleeing in disorder from victory already achieved? Who am I? They mock me, these lonely questions of mine. Whoever I am, thou knowest, O God, I am thine. We'll look again at some stuff tomorrow.